Welcome to another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. I make a mean grilled cheese and an impressive omelet. I'm not bad at cutting up fruit. And that, my friends, wraps up my culinary skills. My time in the kitchen is spent cleaning up after my husband, who happens to be, thank God, a creative chef who loves to experiment and basically cooks all of our meals. Our two sons inherited those genes. I may not like or want to cook, but I certainly appreciate good food, whether dining in or out. And that's why Deborah Gorman is my guest today. Unlike me, Deborah knew she wanted to be creative in the kitchen, spending most of her free time growing up watching her grandmother work her magic. Despite her passion for food, Deborah began her post-college career as a graphic designer and an ad agency producer. But just like acid reflux, the desire to be in the kitchen kept coming up. So against all odds, Deborah landed a line cook position under Dan Barber, executive chef at Blue Hill at Stone Barns in Westchester. Then came a line cook stint at Manhattan's Avoce restaurant, where she focused on pastry. That was followed by time spent at executive chef Greg Kuntz's two elegant restaurants, Gray's and Cafe Gray. Deborah's accomplished a lot in her 33 years, working as a private chef, spending summers cooking for the rich and famous both in the city and in Tony East Hampton, Long Island. In 2008, she founded The Good Knife, a catering company. 2 years later, she was a finalist on the Food Network hit Chopped. In 2011, Deborah moved to Southern California, becoming the pastry chef at Eleni Oyster Bar, and in 2012, began testing sorbet recipes. Not long after, she signed on as co-founder and executive chef of Gourmet Sorbet by the Sorbabes. She also consults for restaurants in the L.A. area. Well, have I whet everyone's appetite? Let's not waste another minute and meet Deborah. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Explain how, against all odds, you managed a coveted line cook position at impressive Blue Hill.
Well, it's actually a funny story because I you know, coming from Washington University in St. Louis, I had, you know, this degree that had nothing to do with culinary arts. But I think because Blue Hill is kind of an interesting place where it's a very conceptual, environmentally driven atmosphere where there's a lot of educated people that have an approach to food that's not only about the art of it, it's also about how food takes place in our society today and politically what food means for us. And then attaching that to the kind of culinary brilliance that top chefs will do in fine dining restaurants. Mm-hmm. So I think that luckily I kind of had an interesting background for them. They saw that, you know, I had a little bit of culinary experience from sort of assisting people working on the side. I'd worked, you know, nights at restaurants just to kind of learn a few things. And I started working there. And I think what happened was in the very beginning, they told me to be there at 10 a.m. And I think I thought it was 9 a.m. So every morning I would get there an hour early. And so it was funny. I didn't realize it until like 2 months later when they offered me a job. And then they were like, oh, you don't have to be here until 10 a.m. And I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, I really was that dedicated, but I think it was just kind of funny because I think that was part of their, you know.
What
they
a hard worker.
Well, this is such a great worker. And I did. I worked, you know, I worked my tail off. And I also was instinctively, you know, being in a restaurant and cooking was just second nature to me.
But did you start off in Tarrytown
I
in
did.
Westchester?
I
because
did.
They have a restaurant in the city.
They do. And I like the restaurant in Tarrytown because I like that when I first trailed there, which is when you go in and you kind of, you go do a tryout for the job. And you just basically follow around another chef and help them all day. And they kind of see how you work and they work with you. And that's like the first day. And they were like, okay, we need some more basil. And I said, okay, I'll go into the refrigerator and get the basil. They're like, no, you need to go outside
and pick
it.
The basil. Right.
And I was like, oh. And that moment, I was like, I want to work here. I don't care how hard it is, I'm going to get into this kitchen. And sure enough, it sort of lucked out that, you know, I worked hard. I got there early every day. And I happened to impress them. And they gave me a position when somebody left. They're like, oh, Deborah's here. You're up.
So for how long were you volunteering there?
Only about 2 months. I think maybe it's less than 2 months, which is rare because people will volunteer. I mean, I don't know if you've heard how it takes to get into some of the top kitchens, but people will trail or stage, it's called. It's a French term.
Stage?
Stage. It's like you basically work for free
it's
for
like
a restaurant.
It's like the three
stages. But not as funny.
Okay.
A lot of hard work and a lot of torture, but it's what you do to kind of prove yourself and also to learn before they give you a coveted line position where, you know, if you mess up, it could mean a lot of terrible things for the restaurant. Mm-hmm. So you have to sort of prove yourself and also learn about the style.
Were you intimidated?
Oh, totally. Every day I came in, like, you know, I'd get up and I'd sleep a few hours because we'd work like 90-hour weeks at the restaurant because we do farm chores and then we would work on the line and then we would clean up. We would actually scrub the kitchen every week. So it was a very, very great training experience, but also intense because it was all new to me. You know, everything, like the terminology, I had never worked in the line as a line cook before and I didn't know anything. And they throw me in and I just sort of have to, it's either sink or swim. And some days I sunk and some days I swam and other days I just sort of tread water. So,
did you even know what a line cook was?
I didn't know. I kind of got it. Like, I'd read, you know, Anthony Bourdain's book, and I'd understood what that meant. But all I knew is what I had to work in the best restaurant I could get myself into and work as hard as I could, and instead of going to culinary school. So I'm sort of self-taught, but I don't like that term because I feel like I really was taught by these great chefs that I worked under. And if something I didn't know, I would, you know, I'd investigate and learn it. And if, you know, something, a term came up, I didn't know, understand what it was, I'd look it up and, you know, watch a video online. Luckily, the internet, you know, that's all available. So I kind of taught myself in that way. But I really learned most of my skills from the great chefs I've worked with.
Well, how many Deborah Gormans, for example, were at Blue Hill when you were there?
Other stages or other women?
Oh, well, that's a good question. How about both?
There were probably about 4 or 5 stages that were working there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I guess I did have, they had, most of them had graduated from culinary school, and it was part of their culinary education to do
to apprentice. Stage.
Yeah, to apprentice, right. And so they were on like a track that they had to be there for this amount of time versus when I came in, I was like, I'm volunteering my time. Nobody else is telling me to be here. I just want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was actually to my advantage at that time, which just seems odd because you think if you go to culinary school, you can get into a kitchen. But I mean, culinary school is awesome. I just happened to learn from my grandmother, like, how to cook, and I felt really confident in the kitchen. So for me, it was easy to just jump in and learn. And the funny thing is I talked to another person who had a similar experience to me at Blue Hill, is they put you in the Muse Bouche station, which means you're part of garmanger, which is part of the salad station. But the amuse-bouche is the very first thing you get when you sit down. You know those little things, little cute
sampling. Oh, right, like token.
Yeah, stuff they just give you when you get it to a restaurant.
And it's called amuse-bouche?
Amuse-bouche. It's a French term to amuse your palate.
Oh,
amuse your mouth. And so that was my station. So I was the very first impression. Every guest came
in,
which is crazy because, you know, and you get hit so fast. So as soon as things start, you get like 10 orders and then VIPs are showing up and you have to like do 10, you know, multiples and you have to come up with all this stuff. And every day I would like, you know, it was really stressful. And I actually came up with an amuse-bouche one day because we ran out of one thing and I switched something
else.
I invented one and I was like, Dan Barber, what do you think of this? And he's like, okay, run it. And I was like, oh my gosh, okay. And like that was my kind of exciting moment where I was like, oh, wow, I can do this. So after that, I burnt out actually after a year there because it was 90-hour weeks and it was intense. And I think, you know, as much as I loved it, it was a little bit too intense for not having any experience to work in probably one of the toughest kitchens in New York City. It was a little bit like at some point I just sort of was like, okay, I need a little break and I can.
Does he have a reputation? I mean, obviously he's skilled and very
talented.
He's
really intellectual. His idea of food was very much like farm. He like kind of brought farm to fork to the East Coast. That restaurant was probably the most amazing experience for me and what I learned the most from. And I still use the techniques and styles and what I learned just from observing everybody in that kitchen in my cooking today.
If you were working 90 hours a week, what the hell was your hourly salary?
You didn't get paid for all your hours. It was sort of expected that you sort of volunteer for the additional hours because part of it was you were being there was no possible way they could pay you for all those hours. You know, but also the Rockefeller Foundation did help fund that restaurant. So that restaurant had an interesting relationship with financing because most restaurants, labor is the most expensive cost. And you know, that's why, I mean, I worked in restaurants for so many years and I kind of see it as my education. But after that, you know, I realized my salary cap was, you know, $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And unless I was the chef or the guy with the name on the door or the woman with the name on the door, I was limited to what I could do. So, or how much money I could make. So I didn't get paid nearly enough for those hours. However, you know, they did take care of us. You know, there were a lot of perks to the job.
They fed you.
They fed us. We ate very well. Family meal at that restaurant was incredible. You know, it's like we would eat amazing produce and amazing protein, you know, from or different just incredible stuff. So that experience just like, but the thing, funny part was that I hardly ever had time to eat family meal because I was so rushed that like to take a half an hour of my day to sit down and eat lunch or eat like, you know, your meal was like unheard of. So I would always be eating like
on the run. Like fast food.
It totally was. So you're like surrounded by all this amazing food and you're starving. And you're like, oh my God, this is just wrong. But it was amazing. I mean, the experience was incredible. And I, as much as I was tortured and sort of loved it and hated it, and I just knew, and in hindsight, it was like the most incredible thing.
So how old were you during that stint?
I was 26.
26.
And I was old. I was like one of the older people in the kitchen.
Interesting.
Which are line cooks in the kitchen. Most people were in their early 20s.
Then it was time to sort of bid Blue Hill bye-bye. Mm-hmm. And you headed back into the city, and you went to Avoce, right?
Mm-hmm.
Describe the contrast between the two.
Well, it was I changed positions. So I actually, and Dan Barber suggested maybe that pastry, like when I was working with him, he's like, you might be better at pastry. Not that he's like, you're a good line cook, but he's like, I can see that that might be something that you...
That's a more creative
way that for you to work. And the funny part, and this is partly because I'm a woman, is like being a pastry chef, women sort of always sort of end up in pastry. And it seems like, I'm not sure why, maybe it's the heat of the kitchen. It just, and I think because I'm such like a rebel, I guess in some ways, I always kind of attract careers. I was like, I want careers where like I have to prove myself or do something. And I think that, not careers, but I guess in the culinary world, I've always sort of ended up in scenarios where like, I'm not going to do what's expected of me. I want to do more.
Mm-hmm.
So part of me was like, oh, of course, like he's going to tell me I should be a pastry chef because I'm a woman, you know, and that was my first thought. And that's sort of a stereotype. In reality, I think he was right in some ways because I do enjoy the meticulous science of pastry and understanding and measurements and that. And it's something I utilize a lot now. So when I went to Avoce, they happened to have a pastry position open.
And you applied for that job?
Well, I just applied for a line cook position. And they saw that, you know, like they're like, well, pastry, you can get in through pastry and then you can end up on the line. So why don't you start with pastry and see how that goes? Because that's where we really need someone right now. And I thought, OK, well, this might be the perfect opportunity to explore this part of my culinary education. And I never really, most chefs are either savory or in the desserts or in the savory side of the kitchen.
What does that mean?
If you're a line cook, you're usually doing meat, vegetables. You know, there's all different stations that you work in and they're not sweet meat or you know, you're doing all the
so
salty food.
You're right. So it's either
You do
sweet,
the savory side or the sweet side.
And the savory is everything but sweet.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So that's sort of, there's a divide there. And most chefs don't sort of
cross
back and forth. And that's something that I guess people have always been impressed by my skills is that I do have equally strong skills in pastry as I do in savory.
But Avoce and Blue Hill, obviously, for people who don't know, and I shouldn't say obviously, are very Tony restaurants that are very expensive. How else would one describe
them? The year that I was at Avoce, it won best like new restaurant by Time Out New York, you know, like things like that. So it was a new restaurant. It had gotten a lot of acclaim. It was hot. And it was technically like a great restaurant. I mean, and it still is. So that was a really great experience to work.
So you cut your teeth on pastry chefery at Avoce.
Yeah.
And that's when you sort of decided I'm going to focus in on that?
Yes and no. I liked it, but I was also still torn at that point.
Okay.
So and when I went to Cafe Grey, and actually I was kind of recruited by that team to start their new restaurant, and I was always excited about starting. I'm an entrepreneur at heart, and so like the idea of starting a restaurant was really exciting to me, and I've always sort of wanted to see from the ground, you know, see something built from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to Cafe Grey, I ended up on the savory side again, and I sort of was open to either or, but that's kind of like I was at that point I was sort of like looking for good opportunity, and this happened to be an interesting one, and they had a good position for me there, and I ended up eventually in their catering department and kind of being involved, like in charge of some of their catering events because they had a big event space. And that actually was my favorite thing. So once I got to that, I realized I'm like, I like being a line cook, but the pressure of a line cook is you're kind of like a robot. You're just basically making the same things over and over and over again. And when it was the catering department, it's like, okay, we know we have to make 100 of these and 20 of those. And like the speed was still rushed, but it was a different experience.
Not maybe as frenzied.
Yeah, it was like a little more organized. And that to me was like, okay, this is kind of more like how I want to cook. And I realized after that my time being a line cook was like, I learned a lot. It was a great experience, but I sort of needed to move on to the next stage of my career, which ended up being catering and then private chefing and doing events.
So what did it kind of average out to be? A year here, a year there?
Yeah, and I think that's something very unique to the culinary world is that people who are learning or who want to just kind of gain experience don't spend too, because you're not making very much money and you're kind of working these crazy hours. So you have like an expiration date, unless you decide that's the restaurant you want to be with the rest of your career and you work your way up and stay in that restaurant. A lot of times chefs kind of jump around and it's expected to sort of learn from different people to kind of create your own vision of what you...
So you're moving on.
Yeah. So you kind of learn as much as you can, or you work as hard as you can at that place. And then you sort of at some point, it's the same food over and over and over again. Unless some chefs do change things up often. Most restaurants, you don't change the menu that often. So, you'd have to wait like a year or two before the menu
Good
changes.
Point.
And then, you're learning things, but not at the speed that most people or some people would like.
And an executive
like
chef, for example, is not interested in your contribution, so to speak.
Yes. It's much about, they understand that it depends on the environment. Every kitchen is very different. Some restaurants do take a lot of time to, mold their employees to... But most restaurants, I think it is, you're a machine. You're working. You're trying to get as much out as quickly as possible. And you don't have a lot of time to be creative and kind of work on things. It's more about gaining the skills and doing the same thing over and over again until it's perfect and then making it that way.
And what it's like to work in that kind of an environment,
yeah.
A high-pressured environment.
It's intense.
I bet it is. So Avoce kind of turns you on to catering. And is that
Cafe Grey.
I meant Cafe Grey.
And
that's what led to The Good Knife. So how did that come about? I mean, you decided it was time for you to leave Cafe Grey?
Yeah.
For each one, you knew when to go.
Well, Cafe Grey closed.
Oh, all right.
It was 2008, and it was, the economy was turning. And unfortunately, Cafe Grey is still in my mind because it exists in Hong Kong. So Grey Coons had taken his visions elsewhere. But unfortunately, in New York at that time frame, it wasn't that economic environment. Cafe Grey was not going to survive. And so they closed their doors. And it was a very sad day because it was kind of like, in some ways, I felt the end of like super fine dining with that sort of vision of excellence and kind of, at least maybe it was the end of an era in New York. And everything seems to be now much more casual and people are not expecting white tablecloths and the same sort of service that they used to receive.
But you're still spending a lot of money if you're not expecting white tablecloths.
Exactly, which is kind of, it was an interesting, it was like a shift in people's, in trends, and what was expected. So when Cafe Grey closed, I kind of was a little bit sort of realizing maybe this is my time to try something, to not be in I wanted to not work on a line anymore and try to see where else my culinary skills I could apply or how else I could apply them.
But it would be ironic to think that, the economic times are tough and now you're going to start a company.
Which was, in hindsight, maybe not the best time. However, private chefing, there's still always a market for that because people do hire people to do their events and people don't often cook in their own homes as much as we wish they would. And I ended up working every summer in the Hamptons as a private chef for one family who basically gave me carte blanche to come up with these incredible meals, and they would invite all their friends over. They entertained constantly, and we would have these incredible dinner parties. So in combination with that job plus my catering company, which was, hung in there for a while, and we still occasionally do events, but it wasn't the greatest time to start a catering company, in hindsight. It was a tough time.
Obviously, to hire a private chef, you got to have a lot of bucks. Did you cook for them three meals a day, or were you on call all the time, or
No.
were these for just dinner parties?
It was a little bit of both. It's funny. I've never been the kind of chef who's always on call, and maybe to my demise, because certain jobs, I kind of see myself as an artist, and a lot of my clients hire me because they know of my skill set, and they appreciate kind of super elegant dinner parties and that event. So the lunches and I never like brunches.
So you're not making grilled cheese.
I was occasionally. You could find yourself. There was a lot of funny things. Occasionally, kids would come into the kitchen and hated everything that was for dinner because, of course, it's like this fancy, beautiful food, and they want plain pasta. So you could find me in the middle of a dinner party whipping up some grilled cheese or some plain pasta with butter for the kid who's I don't know, I don't want to eat it.
Right.
So I working as a private chef is it was a lot of fun for me, and I think you have to have a certain temperament to do it and sort of.
Did you live with the family?
We had a separate little annex where I lived, and I live right on the beach. So it was pretty wonderful. It was a great location.
So it was really only you in the kitchen, so to speak. You didn't have a staff, did you?
Well, they had a staff, so I would pull from the staff occasionally. So I would have assistants on dinner party nights. almost everybody just showed up in the kitchen, and I would give everybody a little job, and I'd have them plating and helping me. And so that was kind of interesting to see myself. Like, after I'd worked for so many chefs who had yelled and screamed and went crazy, all of a sudden I find myself screaming at some poor lady who doesn't cook for a living, that, like, she's plating too slow. And I'm like, oh,
like,
no.
She knows what plating too slow means.
It was pretty wonderful. I mean, it's a pretty interesting experience. I loved it. I happened to work for wonderful, wonderful people who I respect and adore.
Did you only do that one summer?
No, for it was them? 5 summers.
For them?
5 summers.
So it was like a second family for
you?
Yeah.
Yeah, 5 summers, and then I would be working on The Good Knife during the rest of the year, and we did all kinds of fun events. We would do these monthly dinner parties. So it was the catering company. I mean, setting up a catering company in New York is difficult because kitchen space is really expensive. You know, having a good workforce, and you kind of have to be really big to do it well. So we kind of did these really fun. We were kind of like a floating catering company where we.
Who's
would,
the we? How many we were there?
There was me, and there was two of us plus like some other chefs that would kind of jump in, and we'd all sort of work together on different events. And occasionally, you know, we'd bring our own clients to the table, and we'd kind of do events together. So it was a really fun way to bring another level of cooking to New York. And it was casual, and we'd do these fun dinner parties, and people would just, you know, random people would come. It was kind of like an underground supper club, which was really hot.
Would that be at different people's homes or?
Mm-hmm. People's homes or in event spaces and galleries. Like, we did kinds of really interesting events that we would just show up at. And I've actually, some like really crazy events. Like,
can you share one and drop some names, any boldface names at
well,
some of those events?
One of the craziest event I've ever done. And it was for an artist who's Lainey Dalby is her name, and she basically served a meal on her body. She was naked. Mm-hmm. And she had other people, and she wanted me to put different food that would be affected by the temperature of her body, and people ate it off of her. And this was, I was like, you know, I'd had other crazy things that people asked me to do. Like, someone asked me to cater a placenta party.
Oh, not another placenta party. Good Lord. Wait, let's go back to Lainey. So what are people – I guess it's mostly canapes, right?
Yeah. It was actually – I think we did all desserts. So one was actually made with gelatin. So when it hit her body, it started, like, melting,
oh,
which is crazy.
Oh, that sounds appetizing.
Yeah. Another one was a chocolate – it was like a chocolate tart, and I think – and then I did one that was – it was like a little mini one. It was a little square tart. And then I did a piece of watermelon with some, like, feta. It was, like, a little mini feta salad on, a little watermelon.
Anybody just, like, use a knife and fork on her?
No. They actually had their hands tied behind their back, too. So they had to physically lean over and eat. And it was so funny because it was just a bizarre. It was, like, one of the most – and she was actually applying – she had it all videotaped, too. And so I would be coming around putting these things on her body. And I'm just like, this is awesome.
Because you had to keep refilling her.
Yeah.
So to speak.
And she's, like, this incredible artist who's, like, totally just an awesome woman who's crazy and all into, like, sexuality and love. And she just has this really interesting
How many people were at that event?
There were about 10 or 15 people. It was small.
Because you can't get crazy.
Yeah.
So you were making a living, earning a living.
I was actually those years I did very well. And I was actually, it was incredibly well compared, you know, to what I was making as a line cook. And then all of a sudden I just, you know, realized how much I could charge for it's funny because being a line cook, you just don't expect to make very much money ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a hard thing to realize at that point in my life because I was like, oh, you know, I went to this great college and I had this, you know, wonderful education, and I'm like, how do I make this into a living, or how do I actually, you know, pay my bills in New York City with what I chose to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of been a challenge, you know, ever since I started. But I sort of crave challenges. I don't do well with something that people say it's easy. I'm like, nah, I don't do that.
You ought to try easy. There's a lot to be said for easy.
Maybe someday.
But speaking of the opposite of easy, now we have to get to something really seminal in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You were on Chopped.
Yeah, that was crazy.
How did that happen? And were you also not in competition with one of your former bosses?
I was.
Why don't you tell that story? That was in 2010, right?
So actually, yeah, they had approached me.
This is the Food Network.
Yeah.
Cult hit, I suppose you could say.
The Food Network approached me in 2010 to be on their show because they knew about the Good Knife and they knew my background. And so I was like, yeah, why not? This seems like a good, you know, opportunity. I'm like, why not? It actually sounded really fun because I like challenges. Like,
so
crazy
you said.
So I was like, let's try this. And I'm actually prepping a party in in the kitchen that we're working at the time for a Good Knife event. And I hired one of my old coworkers from Cafe Grey. And we're talking, and she goes, you know, she's like, oh, did you hear that Martin's going to be on Chopped? And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I'd already, like, had my date booked and all
and
this
who's
stuff.
Martin?
Martin was my old chef.
At Cafe Grey?
Cafe Grey. So he was my boss and good friend. So I was like, oh, really? Do you know what the date is? Because all of a sudden in my head, I'm thinking, uh-oh. Sure enough, it was the same date that I was competing. And it's funny because this is all supposed to be confidential. You're not supposed to talk about this. And so I call him up and I say, guess what? Like, we're competing against each other on Chopped.
Isn't that wild?
And I was like, all right, whoever wins takes the other person out to dinner. Like, that's it. Let's have fun with this. It's for TV. It's not for, you know, it's like, it's not really
but
real.
There is a dollar prize.
Yeah, you win $10,000. Fortunately or unfortunately, it was his birthday that day. So I came into this competition being like, the guy who has, like, you know, who I called my boss for so many, you know, such a long time and I respect and who has probably 10 or 15 years of experience on me, I'm competing against. And so it didn't help as far as me kind of playing to win.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this respect level in kitchens where you treat your chef like, you know,
a
he's
god.
A god. You know, mm-hmm. you treat him like with utmost respect and you do whatever he asks no matter what. So to be put in competition with this person was really kind of like a mind-bending moment,
mm-hmm.
and it was hard. So I, you know, I just went into it with like, all right, I'm just going to have fun and try to win and we'll see what happens. Like, no expectations. After the first round, I was like, please chop me. It was like 20 minutes. They're in your face every second with these cameras. And you're like, you're just trying to cook as fast as you can. You have to come up with.
Did you know what you were doing?
No, you're not even. You're just like, you're in like memory mode. Like, you're just like, okay, I know how to cook. I see these ingredients. I got to make it into
a
dish.
That is so absurd.
Yeah.
You know, what? Pig's feed and what? And sorbet or something.
Yes.
Insane.
Yes. Insane. So, I mean, luckily when I got there, I saw an oyster knife sitting on the side of the basket. And I was like, oh.
What do you think? I can stab myself with
yeah,
that?
Right. That was my second thought. My first thought was like, okay, there are oysters in there. I'm like, all right, I can't do oysters on a half shell. I got to do something different. I got to do something different. And that's like my whole mantra in life. Like,
mm-hmm.
I got to be different. I got to do something exciting and new. And so I made a salad with like marinated oysters. And, you know, the judges were impressed. They were like, oh, the other three contestants all did oysters on a half shell with some sort of mignonette like topping or, you know, which was expected. And so that kind of got me past the first round. And the salad came out good and actually had nice spice. And I was actually impressed. It was a little overdressed, but that was actually because it sat in a room for too long. And so that after that that round, I was like, oh, my God, I made it to second round. And the second round, I was just – they gave me the worst ingredients I could ever
imagine.
They
gave everybody the worst
yes.
ingredients.
But for me, I'm Jewish.
Uh-huh.
I grew up not eating pork. And they give me like a whole pork loin. And I'm just looking at it like, it doesn't even look appealing. You know, it's like, it's just this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's,
what do I do with this?
What do I do with this? And then they gave me jackfruit in a can.
I don't even, what is jackfruit?
It's like the stinkiest, most disgusting fruit. And that's what they gave you in a can. And then the third ingredient was buttermilk.
Ugh.
So I just looked at it going.
And yeah, let's cut my loss here.
I was just kind of like, I try my best, but I actually played at it going like, if I win this round, this is totally rigged and there's no way. Because
mm-hmm.
it was.
But did you love the experience?
It was great. It was really fun.
And what we see on TV is what we get.
Yeah.
That's sort of what goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah,
also.
I mean, they're trying to get drama. Like the whole time they're asking questions. But actually, the fun thing about me, I respect Martin. I actually respected the other two guys there too because they were. And I tasted, would go around and we tasted their food and they were like, nobody's ever done that before. Like, because Martin and I had this, I was so comfortable with him, I didn't
relationship.
Actually see it. It's like, I'm like, you know what? I'm going in and having a good time and whoever
Did
wins,
he win?
Wins. He ended up winning.
Oh, well,
which,
that's nice.
He, like, should have been judging it. I mean, he is such a talented chef.
So maybe he was the ringer.
Yeah.
Why did you leave New York City for the West Coast? And if you can just sort of tell us how gourmet sorbet by the Sorbabes, which is just ingenious, was born.
It was in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
It was my season. My life is a little seasonal. So every summer I'd work really hard and into the fall. And then somewhere around January, no more events. Catering kind of like dies off.
Mm-hmm.
And then
You crash.
I kind of just crash for a few months. But then from January to March, there's like very little activity in my world. So it's kind of nice, but I was sort of, you know, I was feeling like New York City was just not right for me at this point in time. It was just, I felt to keep up in New York is a hard city to live in. I've grown up there. I never felt totally at home there, and I decided that, you know, I've always sort of dreamed of living in California, and our friends happened to have a sublet available in their building that was cheap, was very cheap, and my husband, who at the time was my boyfriend, decided that he wanted to leave his job. And I was like, you know, I've always wanted to cook in California. I always feel like that's where all the best produce is. Like, it's beautiful all year round. You can get great ingredients. Like, the winter in New York City is depressing to me. And it was just like no, you know, you go to the farmer's market and all you see is potatoes and a few apples that have been sitting in storage for a few months. And it's just like everything's flown in from California. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, I'm like, let's just try California for a while and try that lifestyle, see what it goes. And we happened to love it. And so I started right away working at a restaurant called Animal, which is one an interesting restaurant in L.A. because it's all about pork and fatty foods. We're in a culture where L.A. people
are thin
and eat, are obsessed with being dieting.
Eating nothing.
Yeah, and plastic surgery. But it turns out that California, or especially Los Angeles, the food environment is really changing and people are wanting more and excited about new foods. And similar to what's happening, it's happened in New York. It's been always part of New York lifestyle. It's happening in California. So I was just excited about having such going to a farmer's market and having this incredible bounty of produce. So I started working at that restaurant. And then I started working at, I helped open Eleni Oyster Bar when they opened. And I became their pastry chef and then moved on to consulting for them. And while I was there, I got a call from kind of a connection through the family I worked in the Hamptons, and she was working on this sorbet company. And she's like, can I commission you to make recipes for me? And I said, okay, sure, why not?
I'm had like, you ever made sorbet before?
Yeah, I had. Okay. When I was at Avoce, I learned how to make sorbet.
Okay.
So I was like, yeah, great. I'm like, that sounds fun. I love it. Love the science of it. So cool. And we started working together, and we had this great rapport. And in the course of a month or so, I came up with all these fun ideas. And she was like, do you want to be my partner? Do you want to be in it more than just, you know, she was going to offer me a small percentage for recipes. She's like, I want you to be my 50% partner. Like, you know, let's do this. And I was like, okay, let's try it. Why not? And so Gourmet Sorbet, at that time, she had picked the name Gourmet Sorbet, and we weren't the sorbabes yet. We came up with all these recipes. I came to New York for the summer because we decided we would, I was actually working for the same family that summer. So I come up with the recipes, and we figured out how we would do production, and we sold these different farmers markets. At night, we would make our sorbets at an ice cream shop in Brooklyn. So we would go into the shop at, like, I guess it was like 11 o'clock at night, and we'd use their machines because they have these giant, you know, batch freezers with compressors in them to make ice cream. And when we get there, they somehow dubbed us the sorbabes. They're like, oh, the sorbabes are here. And we thought it was...
Oh, so you didn't come up with
it. We didn't
that.
Come up with it.
Well, it's still a great name.
So actually, I give credit to the manager at Ample Hills Farm, Ample Hills Creamery, actually. And he came up with the name, and he just kept calling us sorbabes. And we're like, and then we started telling people, and everybody just loved it. They thought it was hilarious. It took me a while, actually, to be comfortable with it.
Because I understand.
It just, you know, and my partner also is just like, she's beautiful. And both of us were like, well, we're like, we don't want to just be, you know, known for the way we look or who we are.
Of course.
Or just being a woman.
But your reputations precede you.
Right.
And it's very clever, and it's something that sticks in people's heads.
People remember it. And it's also fun. I think we're kind of reclaiming that term, babe, because people use it all the time, like for friends, like, hey, babe, what's up?
Exactly.
So it's not, its connotations are no longer just like a sex symbol. It's more of kind of a term of endearment.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what we've come up with, and we think it's great, and people love our flavors.
I mean, name some of your flavors.
Yeah, we do a cucumber white wine mint, which is incredibly refreshing. Our probably most famous flavor so far has been our organic pistachio with sea salted caramel, and it's made with just pistachios and purified water, sea salted caramel, and that's basically it. Like, it's not, it's got no dairy alternatives in it, but it has this incredibly creamy texture.
Uh-huh.
So it's really interesting. People have been amazed. They're like, oh, this is not sorbet. And we're like, well, sorbet is a non-dairy frozen dessert, and this is sorbet, but we've kind of taken a twist on it. And now we came up with a peanut banana with spiced chocolate, which has been like selling like crazy. Like, we can't keep enough of it in stock. The other ones are coconut chai macaroon. And we have a passion fruit lychee, and we have a strawberry rhubarb crumble. I'm working on two flavors actually today. I'll be going to my test kitchen and working on we're calling it a fall harvest crumble. So it's going to have apple cider, pears, and also like a gluten-free crumble. So all the flavors are dairy-free and gluten-free. So they're kind of, we're just working on that. And you wouldn't miss the dairy or the gluten because they're so incredibly satisfying on their own. So it's a It's been a fun process.
So this is what you're focusing on now.
Yeah, this is my main focus. I still do events, and it's kind of fun to do these events every once in a while because I put that other hat on. And like the summer, I did 2 or 3 catering events this summer in the Hamptons, and it was just hilarious because, like, you know, people hire me. They're like, oh, yeah, we're having 20 people for dinner. And the day before, the woman's like, oh, yeah, 30 people are coming. She's like, actually, I think it's going to be 60 people.
Oh,
and I'm just
God.
Like, are you kidding me?
Oh, wait, lest we forget, there's also the Golden Skillet. Talk to us briefly about that.
The Golden Skillet was a project. Actually, I've changed the name just recently to Grandma's Golden Skillet because it gives it a little bit more of an
idea
of
what it
is.
Going back to your roots, huh?
Yeah. My grandmother taught me to cook, and I realized after she passed away how many recipes I didn't document or how many traditions I lost and or my family lost. And I'd call different people in the family, and they'd say, oh, yeah, I don't remember how she made that. And I tried to recreate it, but it was never right. And it just made me realize how there's a wealth of culinary knowledge out there that's not being done by chefs. It's mostly grandmothers in their kitchens who were, you know, in the 40s and 50s and 60s were the primary cooks in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And their craft, you know, really is an art. And so these women are also hilarious. And I've met them and had great conversations with them. And I decided to start a video project where we would go into their kitchens and actually watch them cook. Because a lot of times they'll give you a recipe and it's like, yeah, it's a dash of that and 3 teaspoons of this, but it's actually 10 teaspoons. And, you know,
as you're watching them do this.
Watching them do it. And you really have to see them cook to get the full experience and get the full recipe. So I started the project with a friend of mine who's also a good cook as well. And she and I have been going around to different grandmothers' kitchens and interviewing them and getting the recipes on film.
So this is history.
This is, yeah.
You're collecting history. Culinary history.
And it's also hilarious. Like, if you go to the Golden Skillet, there's a video that I did of my great aunt, who's my grandmother's sister. And she just, the way, you know, at one moment, she's like, oh, don't take this. Oh, I messed up. And you see her, like, pulling things out and switching them around. And, you know, you can't capture these, like, hilarious moments on camera. And they just, the personality and how incredible these women are. And they're still cooking into their 90s. And, you know, that's the kind of, that inspires me to grow old and become a grandmother and share my culinary knowledge with the next generation as well. So this project, I have had to put it a little bit on hold because of my business
right now. The other things you're involved with.
But it's something that I'm hoping to get back to this year and, you know, create more documented videos of other grandparents.
So what is that, thegoldenskillet.com?
Yeah, it's thegoldenskillet.com.
All right,
yeah.
Look for that. Deborah, it sounds like the world is, no pun intended, your oyster. It's so exciting, and every day it's something new. You're really on a great trajectory.
Yeah, it's exciting. I think that I'm learning every day, and I think that's what keeps me motivated, is that everything I do is just another learning experience, another way to it's also helping, I think, the world in some ways. I love thinking of that, you know, making better food makes mm-hmm. people happier. And I love the moments when people look at me and they go, oh, my God, this is incredible. That happiness that people get from eating something
that you
tastes
created.
So good, that I created. And it's that's what I love.
Oh, wow. Very exciting. It's
yeah.
been nothing short of my pleasure to sit and chat with you today.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you.
I'm Sandy Klein. Join us for another edition of The 51% Conversations with Creative Women.
Thanks for listening to The 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51%. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.